everyone, and welcome to another exciting episode of Four Panel, your weekly guide to the weird and wild world of comics, manga, and all their related spin-offs. I'm Andrew, and I'm just joined by Mick today.
Indeedy, we've lost one.
Yes, much like tiny baby birds and about as good at podcasting, we have flown away from the nest of Rob.
We have.
Try and suss this all out for ourselves.
We are muddling our way through, listeners, because Rob might not be here, but that shouldn't deprive you of your weekly dose of comic goodness.
There's also a good chance that we're not actually recording and you're not listening to any of this.
That is also true.
Or you're listening to it right now because we've somehow managed to accidentally go live across all the internet. Who knows?
I just like the idea that right now in Piccadilly Circus in London, all those lit up signs have just got you and me talking about comics. Yeah. But hey, it'll cause a stir.
It will indeed. So, to give the people what they want, should we talk about some comics?
I think we should.
Excellent. So, yeah, today is going to be another one of our monthly roundup shows of all the things we've been reading. So, Mick, why don't you kick us off?
Okay. So, let me ask you a question, Andrew. What if Marvel came up with some ideas of how their characters might act in other parts of the multiverse?
Then I think you would have a lucrative series of comics on your hand.
I think you're right. And so this is What If With Great Power, a collection of comics where it just takes a little look at what if some of our heroes accidentally ended up in a situation where they got somebody else's powers. I'm not going to list all the artists and writers involved because there's a lot of them. But this contains six stories. You've got What If Flash Thompson Became Spider-Man?
It would go badly.
What if the X-Men were basically digital?
Would go badly.
They're the .exe men. Do you see what they've done there?
.exe, man. I can respect that.
What if Peter Parker became the Punisher?
Oh, me. It would go badly.
What if Marvel Comics went metal with Ghost Rider?
No idea how it would go.
To be honest, that just ended up weird. What if Thor was raised by frost giants?
Oh, that one seems like it would work out fine.
You think?
Yeah.
What if magic became the Sorcerer Supreme?
It would be a comic that I like a lot.
Now, the thing is, of all of them, that was my favourite. Even though I have absolutely no knowledge of who magic is. It's not a character I've come across before.
Yeah, no, it's kind of amazing to me that, like, you get all these ones that are like, here's What If Spider-Man and What If Thor and What If the X-Men and then What If this, like, D-list X-Men character.
Yeah.
But at this point, I think, like, hadn't even been in the comics, really, for a kind of chunk of time.
Yeah. So, well, she's... just to give a quick praise, I mean, the What If Flash Thompson Became Spider-Man kind of goes the way you expect it to. You know, he goes from being the big man on campus to big man on campus with superpowers. And so, you know, he kind of does the whole great power, great responsibility thing in reverse. Originally the What If stories were introduced by the Watcher, but of course now they're not.
What with him having a bad case of the being deads.
That's right. But he was replaced, of course.
Oh yeah, it is like weird space Nick Fury who introduces these stories now, isn't it?
The unseen. Yeah.
That's even by comic standards, that's kind of weird.
It is.
Nick Fury now just lives on the moon watching things.
Yeah. actually takes the job of Watcher far more literally than the Watcher ever did.
Which is impressive, because he's only half as good at it.
The what if X-Men were X-Men kind of works in, it's a bit like, it's kind of like Avatar, but featuring the X-Men. It's more like Matrix, but with X-Men.
Yeah, it's very Matrixy. And
Matrixy, Tron-y, and in one point they actually make Domino look a bit like Scarlett Johansson in Ghost in the Shell.
That's the thing. That's the anime thing that was the big inspiration for it.
Yeah. So there's even one clip where she's dressed like Ghost in the Shell while sitting atop an Akira bike. So let's mix up all the manga.
It's not shy about its references, that one.
And it's an okay story, but it could have been just a comic retelling of the Matrix featuring some X-Men, really.
Yeah, that one I feel like was written around the pun.
Yeah. Peter Parker became the Punisher. It is a slightly different take on Peter Parker, but it's actually not that new a take. If you think of when Peter Parker was at the height of his possession by Venom, it's pretty much the same character.
Yeah, I feel like it's basically that, but a step further, isn't it?
Although it does kills look kind people. Of, yeah, it does look kind of cool seeing the Punisher skull on the spider costume.
Yeah, with like all the webs coming off it. That's a fun look.
It's a fun look, but again, it's not really doing anything new or vibrant or exciting. It's a bit meh.
But I think the important thing about that story is that it exists, and so now there's a good chance that when the Spider-Man game inevitably gets a sequel, that'll be one of the unlockable costumes.
And that might be the point at which I buy a PS4.
You should. It's a very good game.
Yeah, I know, but it's a lot of money to spend on a console, and it's just to play that one game.
It's fine. They're going to be obsolete in like months from now, so you can just fish one out of dumpster.
Yeah, that's right.
I think just on like the release day of the PS5 or whatever it is, just like go to some teenager's house, stand outside the window with your arms open, and just catch the PS4 as it falls out the window.
So the next one was the weird one, which is what if they went metal with Ghost Rider. And it's framed around the visit to Marvel's headquarters of a heavy metal band called Asenwald.
Yeah, the implication I got, because I'll admit, actually, when they were coming out, I bought all of these except for the Ghost Rider one, and it felt like you kind of needed to know who that band were to get it.
I don't know whether they actually exist. I haven't done my research. I should have done, really. But it's actually a bit of a... So you've got Robbie Reyes is actually a Marvel intern at the Marvel offices.
Right.
Wearing his trademark top, but it's actually a hoodie rather than a leather jacket. And he's given the task of giving these heavy metal, supposedly, you know the thing with heavy metal bands, there's always rumours that they're involved in witchcraft and devil worship and all the rest of it. So these supposedly devil-worshipping heavy metal musicians around the Marvel offices. And they're ever so polite, really going against type. So he's guiding them around the offices, takes them down to the printing presses, and it's there where they do their blood sacrifice ritual and unleash all hells into the world. And it's down to Robbie Reyes as the Ghost Rider to try and fight this off. And there's some fun little cameos. It all goes a bit weird. It's a bit Cthulhu-esque in places. And it ends really suddenly with just a blank panel that says in white, about three quarters of the way down. So that one was quite fun. Thor Raised by Frost Giants. It's basically a retelling of Thor and Loki's childhood, but obviously because of the way that Loki is a little bit of a weaselly kind of youth, even when the Frost Giant King has adopted Thor, Thor is still the favoured son.
Because he's got those muscles.
Well, not when he's eight, so much.
I don't know, I think he's still a pretty buff eight-year-old.
But yeah, it's he's still the favoured son. He's the one who's viewed as the likely heir to the throne of the Frost Giants and stuff like that, which causes a bit of rebellion. But again, it's that typical sort of Loki versus Thor sibling rivalry. It doesn't actually change very much. All that happens is Thor becomes the heir to a different throne.
Actually, really enjoyed that one. It was my second favorite one. I quite liked the way it was kind of. It's basically the same as normal, but just sort of inverted.
Yeah. What I like about the magic one is A, I didn't have any background history of Ileana Rasputin. She was effectively a new character for me.
Yeah, because I think even without knowing the backstory, it does a good job of setting up. She's a girl, she's got some weird demon powers, and she's struggling to control them.
Yeah, that's right. And so it picks up with Stephen Strange tracking these outbreaks of supposedly supernatural mayhem that are going down the interstate. And it turns out he's looking to sign up an apprentice and train them up because he's been around the block a few times and he's looking to retire. And it's about him trying to train magic up to become the new Sorcerer Supreme. There's a little twist ending, which I won't give away here. Well, not so much a twist ending, but a twist in the tale, which I really enjoyed. I really enjoyed some of the surreal artwork as well. When you go into the mystic realms and stuff.
Basically everything in that issue looks like a kind of prog rock album cover.
It does, yeah. It's bizarre. Prog rock album cover for a concept album based on Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, I think, is the best way to sum it up.
I think that's a surprisingly good summary.
In that crossover with Hitchhiker's Guide. And, I really like that. Of them all, that is probably my favourite. A lot of the rest I found a little bit staid. I think it's a collection where everybody's going to find their own favourite, and I think it kind of depends on what your Marvel preferences are in terms of your heroes. I do like the variant covers that are basically like Marvel action figures of the What If universe.
See, on the one hand, I do like them, but on the other hand, I hate how much of a tease they are.
What? Like, you can't buy that action figure?
Yeah, like I want an action figure of like Frost Giant Thor, and he's got like Mjolnir, but the hammer's just a giant block of ice instead.
The one I found most disappointing in that was the Rogue for X-Men. Because it's Rogue. It doesn't actually look that much different to any other Rogue action figure.
Yeah, it's it's just Rogue.
So that was What If with Great Power. And I think they're doing a series of these What If. There was collections. I think there's a What If Complete collection out as well. But that's more of the classic What Ifs. Where they're not introduced by Nick Fury. But yeah, it's an okay read. It's not a complete waste of time and money. That's a ringing endorsement, isn't it?
It is.
What have you got for us?
Well, speaking of not wasting time, I have been reading Gleipnir by Sun Takeda. So to read this manga's blurb, Shuichi Kagaya is a smart kid, and most smart kids his age would be thinking about college. Shuichi Kagaya is also a monster, And he's smart enough to know that monsters don't go to college. But after he uses his monstrous form to save his classmate Claire Aoki, it doesn't matter what his plans for the future were, because he's not the one making the decisions anymore. Now with that seductive, sadistic Claire, no, Shuichi's secret, she's got her own ideas about what a monster is good for, because he's not the first one she's met. Anyway, page one, panel one is a shot of Shuichi choking Claire, and you can see her panties, and they're clinging right to her bum, so sod this manga.
Hold on, he knows that monsters don't go to university.
I mean, clearly someone's not seen Monsters University.
Or indeed, Buffy.
Oh yeah, there were so many vampires at that campus. But if anything, university is just a great place for monsters to expand their social horizons.
You've also got, isn't there one called Monster High? A cartoon series called Monster High?
Yeah, that sounds about right.
So basically, what we can ascertain from the comic universe is that monsters are really well educated.
Yeah, God. What do you think? I wish I was a monster.
Yeah.
All those scholarships I could get.
They probably get scholarships and grants, you know, in that kind of, you know, overlooked section of society. Let's give them a bit of a boost. Anyway.
Anyway, yeah, I did give the manga a flip through just to confirm my suspicions, and yep, very fan service heavy.
It's basically a fan service anthology, is it?
Yeah, specifically of, you know, teenage Japanese schoolgirls.
That is a bit of an obsession with some manga, isn't it?
It is. Yeah, it's very much the poster child for, you know, when you say manga to some people and they immediately kind of recoil.
Roll their eyes.
Yeah.
they think you're either talking about pictures of young teenage girls or tentacles.
Often both.
In the same frame.
So yeah, that's one of my immediate turnoffs.
Yeah. I must admit, even the mangas that I do read, when they occasionally have a frame where, you know, one of the characters is coming out of the shower or something like that, that's not adding anything to the story. I know why you've put that in there. You know, come on, you in particular, this manga, are better than that.
Yeah, it's always that slight twinge of disappointment, isn't it? I was enjoying this up to now.
And it's always one of those mangas that's been running for a while where they do it as well. And it's almost like you can spot where there was a slight dip in sales.
I'm going to get those numbers back up. What's that? Oh, the numbers are down. Oh, no, look, we've only got the very small, tiny towels in this hotel room.
Exactly. So, not a ringing endorsement for that one either, then.
No, it can, in fact, get in the bin.
Get in the bin, right.
That's going to be our new system. Is it comic win or get in the bin? I like it.
Hey, it rhymes and everything. That could catch up.
It took me entire seconds to think of that.
Wow. Right. Do we have? What about if we have a comic that's meh, not bad enough to just throw in the bin,
but not a comic win? Ooh, win, get in the bin. Oh, I guess this is Finn.
It's almost worthwhile. It's in the charity shop pile.
I like that. We go. Now we've got like a whole structure to the poem and everything.
Yeah. Let's go with that one. There's a reason I wanted that section.
I suspected. Also, I like that Rob's gone and we've basically fixed the entire show.
Yeah. Shall I cancel all the planes back?
Mick. There are no planes back.
Not now, there aren't.
Wait, that means we're going to have to do all the editing. Wait, even worse, that means I'm going to have to do all the editing.
Not necessarily, because I can learn editing. I mean, I do video editing, and, you know, this is like video editing, but without the pesky pictures that have to sync up with the sound.
You're right.
So, you know, it's kind of easier than the stuff I already do in that regard. Assuming that this is recording and we've actually got a file to edit.
Get a puff. That bit we might need to work on. But I think we've got a solid plan.
Yeah. So, welcome to the now regularly two-handed four panel. Is it me now?
Definitely on Urban Dictionary somewhere. Yep, back over to you.
So I've got Predator, The Essential Comics, Volume 1. An assortment of some of the best Predator stories from over three decades of Dark Horse Comics. And this is a weighty tome, let me tell you. This is nearly 400 pages of Predator stories.
That's a lot of Predator stories.
It
is. Some might say too many.
Well, what it contains is 1989's Concrete Jungle, 1993's Cold War, 1996's Dark River, and the never-before-collected adaptation of the film sequel Predator 2 from 1991. The problem is, out of those 400 pages, I managed to get through 200 before I realised something that I've suspected for a while, but this confirms. Every Predator story is the bloody same.
Yeah, pretty much.
Here's an environment. People start dying mysteriously. Someone investigates, discovers an alien that's invisible for the most part until you find a way to reveal them. Then they have a big fight. Turns out humans are better anyway. The end. Rinse and repeat. And in actual fact, the first story, Concrete Jungle, is basically Predator 2. So you've effectively got the same story twice anyway in this volume.
It's not even the best Predator story.
I know. And it's like, you know, yeah, great. There's Predators, and if you're a big fan of the movies, then great. But surely if you're a big fan of the movies, you've seen this story. You don't need to read it another four times. I mean, there's a slight twist in Cold War in that actually there's a cloaked Predator fleet hanging over the city. But that's it as far as twist goes. Oh, and also the main protagonist is now I can't remember whether it was his brother or his cousin, but basically he's related to Dutch from the first Predator movie.
So I feel like that might even have been like the original pitch for Predator 2.
Absolutely. That's what I mean. You know, it just feels like there was no point in putting Predator 2 in here because it's already there as Predator 1. So, you know, the art's competent. The early ones are in more of a traditional sort of four-colour comic book style. The later ones have got a bit more of a painty feel to them. But it's basically Predator in the city, Predator in Siberia, Predator in the Amazon, and Predator in the city again. Rinse and repeat. It's kind of worthwhile. It's in the charity shop pile.
See, the system works.
Indeed. Over to you, Andrew.
Okay, next up, I have been reading She Could Fly, which is by Christopher Cantwell and Martin Morazzo with Miroslav Mrva. It's just MRVA. I don't know how you pronounce that.
I think it's a sneeze.
Sure, why not? And yes, I know what you're thinking. It is that Christopher Cantwell, creator of AMC's Halt and Catch Fire.
Oh. Which is,
yes, that's a TV show that apparently exists.
It is a TV show. It does exist. I've skimmed past it many a time.
It's maybe about police people or firemen or something.
I have no idea what it's about. I just see it and think, that doesn't look like my kind of bag. I can't see any capes.
Well, do you know who can see capes?
Who can see capes?
Luna Brewster, a disturbed 15-year-old girl who becomes increasingly obsessed with a figure known only as the Flying Woman. So it's basically sort of a real-world setting. only right. one day people just start seeing a random woman flying through the sky. What's going on? What's her deal? Well, before anyone can ask her, she explodes.
Okay. Sounds messy.
It is. But amongst the chunks of fleshy meat and gooey organs is a locket, which Luna finds and sets her down a path of uncovering a weird conspiracy involving a secret government particle accelerator program and a disgraced physicist and his prostitute girlfriend and the Chinese government and Luna's grandma, who's back from being a Buddhist monk in Japan, but also maybe she's got dementia, but that doesn't really factor into the story all that much, so forget about that bit.
Okay.
And it's just, it's very messy. Like, it's one of those things you see a lot when it's comics by someone who maybe doesn't have a lot of comics experience. Is that the pacing's very, this happens, and then this happens, and this happens, and this happens. And there's no kind of real flow between scenes. It just feels like you're getting information kind of chucked at you every few pages.
Okay.
And it's also really odd tonally. Because, like,
inconsistent or?
Yeah. Yeah, inconsistent. Because a lot of it is this kind of sort of serious drama about Luna dealing with what is rapidly becoming apparent is like obsessive compulsive disorder and kind of struggling with all these thoughts that, you know, she's a monster, everyone hates you, whilst also sort of slipping further and further into delusions.
Right.
But then also it's this really over the top, like the government are working on a secret project and they've got their team of wacky assassins out to hunt down the rogue physicist who knows everything about it. And like, this book ends in a massive firefight, which just seems so out of place.
Okay.
It's just, I think maybe I don't like it.
But you're not entirely sure.
No, I feel like it's one of those things where I don't really understand it well enough to not like it.
All right. Is it a bit like when I don't enjoy a comic because it's something that you're more familiar with and I don't want to give it a bad review or a bad score because I don't feel I'm invested enough in the characters?
Yeah, kind of. It's just, it's hard to keep track of, like, there's three or four different shadowy government organizations and then, like, a main character who lots of what she sees isn't real. And also her grandma is, like, quoting weird, vaguely philosophical nonsense all the time.
And sounds like my life.
Yeah, basically, it's... Listener, if you want to experience what it's like to be Mick, I guess read this book.
I think we ought to put in a sort of cautionary note there. You don't want to know what it's like to be me. Trust me, Liz.
I think we're going to need a fourth category of just...
Yeah, let's do that. I like that. Although, I think we'll struggle to find a rhyme.
You're right. You know what? You move on to your next thing. I'll workshop this.
Okay. So, my next thing is The Spine Chillers by Ben Clark, presented in glorious monochromatic vision and published by Renegade.
Wait, I've got it.
Okay.
It's a bit weird. Only read it if you've got a beard.
Do you not think that might alienate some of our beard-wearing listeners?
I mean, I think they knew what they were getting in for.
Okay. All right. Hey, we can run with it. You've workshopped it. We can run some focus groups with the listeners later, see how it's been received.
I mean, to be fair, that initial focus group I ran it through, 100% of participants were okay with it.
Fine. In that case, let's go with it. See how it runs. And, you know, review it in 3 or 4 episodes' time.
I mean, we'll have forgotten about all of this by next week, but yeah, sure.
Yeah. So, The Spine Chillers by Ben Clark. And I was really looking forward to reading this. It's based upon the premise that there is a guest house run by a Mrs. Parkinson, in which Ambrose Bierce, Edgar Allan Poe, H.P. Lovecraft, and at various points, Charles Dickens, M.R. James, and Arthur Conan Doyle.
Okay, I'm certainly intrigued.
And so was I. The problem is that in this 110-page, call it a mini-comic, because it's about two-thirds the size of a standard A4 page, there's 100 pages, and it's the art style is very much your sort of like Saturday morning cartoons in the paper style. In those 100 pages, there's maybe 4 or 5 scenarios that are actually quite humorous and dependent upon the characters. In the rest, they could be any group of people that live under the roof. There's nothing, but there's only very occasionally anything that's properly sort of related to their particular writing skills. There's a quite nice story about one of them getting trapped in a Wicker Man style festival. One of them becomes a weir badger. They need some help hunting down a creature, so they go over to the literary guest house where they enlist the services of Ernest Hemingway. And it's okay, but the problem is that the conceit is based on the fact that these authors are living in this guest house now, not at the time that is, you know, traditionally contemporaneous for them.
Yeah, but I feel like that's a premise you could have a lot of fun with if you bothered to.
Yeah, it's one of those things. The ones that work best are the ones that start off. There's one that starts off with the opening of Quoth the Raven, and that one ends quite funny because of the way it finishes. There's another one where Dickens is visited by 3 ghosts. Those ones that tie it into that character's literary work, they work really well. But, you know, the one where they turn up to audition for Pop Star Factor could be just any group of scroats that live together. So I'm afraid, Ben Clark, this is another one that's almost worthwhile. It's in the charity shop pile.
This is weird. We are not hitting it out of the park with the comics this week.
That's true, but the charity shop's doing really well.
They are, so someone wins.
Assuming they can flog them.
Anyway, back to me.
Indeed.
So, to keep things spooky, I've been reading BPRD Vampire, which is by Gabriel Barr and Fabio Moon. So this is a sequel to the BPRD 1948 miniseries and follows Simon something.
Simon something, you say?
Yep, he's got a last name. I think it begins with an L. Lasker, maybe? Was it Lasker? I don't remember.
Are you sure you've read this?
Anders, Simon Anders. There we go. I knew if I just kept talking long enough, I could find it. So yeah, basically he has been subjected to a curse, and now the souls of 2 vampire countesses live within his body.
Okay.
Basically this details his leaving the BPRD and basically traveling to a town in rural Poland to sort of try and find out how best to remove this curse and kill all the vampires. Which, I mean, if he wanted to, as we've already discussed, he should have gone to a university, but this was back in olden times. They weren't as smart back then.
Indeed.
So, yeah, it's a pretty fun series. Like, it's a nice old-school gothic horror sort of detailing someone descent further and further into madness, with also just some kind of weird monster magic stuff that's a lot of fun. But I think there are kind of mainly 2 things about it. First of all, the art, which I find I'm in a similar conundrum to when I did Polar a few weeks ago, where the art is technically very good, it's also very obviously done in a style that is meant to like ape Mike Mignola's style.
Ah, my least favorite of all the Hellboy styles.
Which, I mean, as we've discussed, is madness, is absolute madness and folly, Mick. But it's I don't know, art criticism wise, how much is it a good thing to say this art is good because it looks like someone else's art?
Well, I mean, the thing is, if you're commissioned to write, let's say you're commissioned to write a Hellboy comic, I guess Hellboy built its reputation, or a BPRD comic, that whole world built its reputation based on the art and writing of Mike Mignola. So emulating that style is probably a wise move. I mean, it could be that it's an editorial direction that they, you know, oh, can you draw this so that it looks like all the other stuff we've done?
Yeah, I mean, I would imagine it's probably, you know, a little bit of column A, a little bit of column B. Yeah, but I guess it's the question of do I say it's good that, you know, you've imitated Mignola's style because that is kind of integral to Hellboy, or do I want to say it's not that great because as an artist, you've kind of been doing what is your style? Yeah, exactly. Like what is your style? What can you bring to the table? Especially because Gabriel Barr, he was the artist for Umbrella Academy.
All right.
I think it would have been interesting to see him maybe bring sort of a bit more of that style to it.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, I've not seen the comics for him. I've just watched the TV show because I am lazy.
It's kind of this weird sort of washed out. And I guess a lot of it is that Dave Stewart is doing the colours and he is the regular colourist for all the Hellboy stuff, so that's probably had a big impact.
Right.
But I think it'd be interesting to see more like weird sort of emo, gothy Gabriel Barr people involved. But then also the big thing for me for this was that this is a sequel to BPRD 1948, and a lot of it seems to be setting up sort of the plot line for what I assume is going to be like the sequel series. And it's just, it's kind of starting to get to me with a lot of the Hellboy and BPRD stuff. There's not really any sort of self-contained stories anymore.
No, they're going down the arc plot route.
Yeah, it's lots of setting up arc plots and arc plots across lots of different sorts of series where it's, and again, it's a Marvel-type problem where it's not just like you read issue one of Spider-Man and then the story continues in issue two of Spider-Man. It's like you've got to read BPRD 1948, but then you've got to read Vampire so that then you can read 49 or whatever.
Yeah.
But then there's BPRD 1952, which is a completely separate thing. And like you read all of Hellboy and then Hellboy ends, but it's not the end of Hellboy because now you've got to go back to BPRD to read more of the Hellboy story. That's just, it would be nice to read a book that's, you know, just a book.
Yeah. This is the beginning. This is the middle. This is the end. You don't have to buy any more if you don't want to.
Yeah, exactly. Just a nice complete whole. So yeah, I think this is maybe another, it's almost worthwhile. Put it on the charity shop pile. But maybe with the possibility that you'll take it back off again if your mood changes.
You see, it's been so long now, I've forgotten what the actual phrase is for a win.
I believe it was comics win. Because it's the opposite of get in the bin.
Yeah, but what did we go with it? Comics win. We only really had a big phrase for the mid-range, didn't we?
Yeah, we did.
Okay.
Have we maybe actually not thought this out that well?
Well, we've been kind of thinking it through on the fly, haven't we? I mean, you've got that focus group that you kidnapped earlier sat in the room with you.
That's true. I guess they're slightly confused by this freeform jazz approach to reviews.
Yeah. Anyway, are you ready for a potential? It gave me a grin. It's a comics win.
Oh, I like that. I like that.
Yeah? Yeah? Creative freedom we have when Rob's not here.
It is just those inspiration juices are flowing all over the place.
They are, aren't they? And there's
actually quite wet and sticky now and rather uncomfortable.
So, what I've got here from Marvel is Domino, Soldier of Fortune.
Hey, lovely Domino.
Lovely Domino. And this follows on from the one that I did a few weeks ago, which collected Domino 1 to 6. This is written again by Gail Simone, with art by David Baldion, Michael Shelfer, Alberto Albuquerque. That can't be his real name. And Anthony Piper. And it also collects the story.
I think is what was his name again?
Alberto Albuquerque.
See, I think his real name is Alberto Left.
Yeah. And so you've got a collection here of issues 7 to 10 of the Domino Run, and Domino Annual number 1. And I really like these. This has an arc story with a couple of standalone adventures, and it's some of it flashes back to her forming her gang of gal pals with Diamondback and Outlaw. We also have some guest appearances by Cable and Colossus.
Domino's big beefy ex-boyfriends.
Absolutely. And in actual fact, in some of this, she's actually, we get a flashback to when she's actually still with Cable. And the main antagonist across these, well, he's kind of a bit of both, an antagonist and an ally, is Mobius, the living vampire.
Mobius, the Eurotrash vampire. Soon to be irreparably ruined by Jared Leto.
Oh, what is it with Leto? What's he got against comics?
I think he personally hates us and is determined to ruin things we like.
Oh, God, he's going to get cast as Domino in the movie, isn't he?
Oh, no, he is. We are all going to be Harrison Ford in Blade Runner 2049. With just barely concealed contempt behind our eyes. I just love how in all his scenes with Jared Leto, you can just tell that. Shut up, God, just shut up.
But yeah, so this is, again, it's that lighthearted, it's good fun. It's kind of setting Domino up as the sort of Marvel Harley Quinn, but with slightly less being the almost fan service approach that they took to Harley Quinn.
Yeah, it's kind of less of the desperate shoving it in your face, screaming, please love me.
Yeah, she's just delightfully broken and quick-witted. And it continues to just be a delighter. So it's definitely one that gave me a grin. Comics win.
It is. But also, do you want the good or the bad news?
I want the good news.
Well, if you're getting the bad news, Domino has been cancelled.
No!
But Domino will return in the miniseries Domino Hotshots. And by will return, I mean it's currently returning because it's out now.
Cool. I want it.
I mean, we'll probably get it, I would assume.
Yeah, we get so many.
So many.
So many. That's why we do these monthly catch-ups.
It's just like desperately bucking, like with buckets, just pulling out the sinking boat.
I remember a time when I used to read books as well.
No, that can't be right.
18 months ago, I bought the Song of Ice and Fire collection. It's still shrink-wrapped.
Oh, yeah, no, you're not going to read that. Not until there's some kind of like Brexit-induced mass power cut.
Or a massive writer's strike in the comics world.
This is just going to be that one episode of The Twilight Zone, isn't it?
Oh, that's every Thursday night. What else have you got?
Yeah, so to round us off, I've been reading Secret Agent Deadpool, which is written by Christopher Hastings with art by Salvador Espin and colours by Matt Yaki and letters by Jimmy Betancourt. So this is another one of those initially released online, but now first time in print. I think it might have even been an exclusive to Comixology.
All right.
And this follows Wade Wilson, everyone's favourite merc with a mouth, on a new and exciting mercenary mission to save a high-value target from a kidnapper. The target being Clopples, one of the world's most adorable ponies.
Okay.
Who's been horse-napped by a pony pimp who's going to rent out Clopples to make beautiful horse babies.
Okay.
So Deadpool chases down the horse-napper, gets in a gunfight, kills the guy, takes over the truck, doesn't look where he's going, accidentally drives off a cliff, gets stuck on a branch, only to see a mysterious figure with half a stone face rappel down from a ladder and just steal Clopples right from under him. But Wade's got no time to think about his new nemesis because he's got another job to do. Take out some jerk who's been sleeping with his client's wife.
Okay.
So he does. Wade goes to a casino, meets Burns, Jace Burns, the smug womanizing, always wearing a tux jerk, gets in a big fight with him. The hotel accidentally explodes. And we find out that Burns, Jace Burns, is a secret agent and member of the RMA. The Resource Management Agency, who are an elite service of secret spies working for the US Department of Agriculture.
Of course they are.
Oh, it's okay. It all makes sense. It's just thanks to a budgeting error, giving them near unlimited money, they've slowly expanded their remit to include, well, if the entire world's destroyed, that's a threat to crops. And now a big James Bond-esque secret spy agency. And they mistake the horribly burned body of Wade Wilson, who always looks like that, for the horribly burned body of Jace Burns. And so Deadpool becomes a secret agent. And he loves it because it's like his normal job, but with cooler toys. Like, I think that because obviously there's, your typical James Bond gadgets. One of the most recurring ones is a missile watch. And the best one, which leads to just some really gross fight scenes, is a pill that includes a snowmobile. So like you break open the pill and it turns into a snowmobile. So of course there are fight scenes of just Deadpool shoving pills into people's mouths and then snowmobiles bursting out of them.
Okay. Interesting.
And of course he finds out that his statue-faced nemesis in fact works for the mysterious organization Gorgon.
Gorgon.
They are every evil villain cliche, and they want to rewrite the world with some weird cosmic rock thing. Yeah, it's just a tremendously fun little series. It's like it's the kind of thing that Deadpool's really good at, where it's just completely self-contained. You don't really need to know anything about anything. Well, I think you kind of need to know about one fairly obscure character for one of the jokes at the end. But apart from that, don't need any prior knowledge. And it's a silly adventure with lots of good gags.
Excellent. So in our new scoring system.
Well, this one definitely made me grin. So it's a comic book win.
Yay.
Oh, sounded just like Clopples.
So, of course, what you said was that was rounding us off, but I have got one more left.
You're right, I forgot my mistake.
So, regular listeners will know that over the past few months, I've kind of delighted in the work of Troy Nixie.
You have, for reasons I don't quite understand fully, but whatever.
I never quite understand fully. I just kind of like it. There's a strange surreality to Troy's work that I kind of like. And I really want to see the one where he's worked on a Neil Gaiman story as well. However, unlike Black Sinister and Vinegar Tea, Trout, Bits and Bobs didn't thrill me.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
We were so close to ending on a good note.
I know. I mean, it's okay. And it's got Troy Nix's trademark, surreal artwork, slightly weird characters. But I think, and this is a collection of Trout's first appearances in Dark Horse Presents and the original Oni Press collection of Trout by Troy Nix. So I think this is fairly early work. So, but the world building isn't there. So Trout is this sort of toddler that lives in a factory, a turnip factory, lives above the turnip factory, and has these strange nightmares and dreams. And sometimes things escape from his nightmares and dreams. And that's about as much as I can tell you about the world. And that's the problem for me, I think. There's not enough world building gone on. It's just this, it comes across as feeling like surreal for surreal's sake. You haven't got that narrative that you've got with something like The Black Sinister, where you find out that, you know, he's basically the Batman of that world, but he only saves the innocents of the city he lives in so that they can continue working in basically slave conditions in his factory. There's none of that element to it.
It's just, here is some weird stuff.
This basically feels like I'm being weird because I can. And it kind of spoils it because the stories themselves are solid. You just don't really know. There's no real sort of link to the pantheon of nightmares that he's subjected to. There's no explanation as to why he lives upstairs in the turnip factory. There's a vague inference that he's the son of someone else who appears in the stories, but it's never sort of concretely stated. It just falls a little bit short. However, it's more a case of, you know, if you're a fan of the outrageously bizarre, it might be okay. You might find it's almost worthwhile. Charity Pile.
Well, there we have it. The lackluster ending to this week's show.
Absolutely. But hey, we've now got a format that we can carry forward.
I mean, we're definitely going to forget all about it, but yes.
I mean, you know, we can do that. It's almost like, I mean, it depends, because as we know, technically, there may not actually be a recording of this show. So you may be right. It may all be lost by next week, which would also kind of render that statement redundant. But, you know, we'll always have this episode as a reminder of our new, don't forget that. We could even make a sort of note about it somewhere that we could refer to on a regular basis to remind ourselves.
Oh, this is getting scary into like actual organization territory.
I know, right? I'm a little bit frightened.
I know. I opened up this whole can of worms just because I wanted to make a show where we all talk in rhyme, like Etrigan the Demon. Thanks very much for listening. If you've enjoyed what you've heard, you can find more of us online. We are on Audio Boom. We're on iTunes, or you can find us on the Geek Show website, where you can also check out reviews and some of our other great podcasts, like Cinema Eclectica, our movie review show, which also I'm sometimes on. Also mix on it, I guess. If that interests you.
Yeah. That's assuming that I've got time between now and the recording of the next Eclectica to watch Endgame. It's going to be a tight squeeze.
I mean, it is, considering it is at least like 24 hours long.
Yeah, if I set off now, I might just make it. So I better pack my 3D glasses.
Well, except you can't, because we are still watching Infinity War, and we will always still be watching Infinity War, because it is forever.
Yeah, that's true. Unless I do this.
Oh, you did a snap, that.
I did. We might edit that bit out, yeah?
Yeah, we might edit that bit out. Anyway, if you've enjoyed this, why not leave us a like, a review? Tell us about some good comics you've been reading recently. But until next time, I've been Andrew.
I've been Mick.
So long, and thanks for listening.
Goodbye now.